to undertake some light nursing responsibilities at a college of healthy young men, and would be happy to do so in addition to being in charge of the linen. Once arrived, it seemed that she was seldom absent. There were very few applications to Father Sebastian for leave, and it seemed that she preferred to spend holidays in her cottage, where she was joined by her only child, an army officer. The general impression gained from the file was of a conscientious, hard-working, essentially private woman, with few interests outside her son. There was a note on the file that he had been killed 18 months after her arrival at St. Anselm's. He put the file in the desk drawer, showered, and went to bed. Clicking off the light, he tried to compose himself for sleep, but the preoccupations of the day refused to be banished. He was standing again on the beach with Father Martin. He saw in imagination that brown cloak and cassock as precisely folded as if the boy had been packing for a journey, and perhaps that is how he had seen it. Had he really taken them off, to clamber up a few yards of unstable sand layered with stones and precariously held together with clumps of grassy earth? And why make the attempt? What, if anything, did he hope to reach, to discover? This was a stretch of coast where, from time to time, parts of long-buried skeletons would appear under the sand or in the cliff face, washed up generations ago from the drowned graveyards now lying a mile away under the sea. But nothing had been apparent to any of those at the scene. Even if Treves had glimpsed the smooth curve of a skull or the end of a long bone jutting from the sand, why would he have found it necessary to take off his cassock and cloak before attempting to reach it? To Dalgleish's mind, there had been something more significant in that neatly folded pile of clothes. Hadn't it been a deliberate, almost ceremonial, laying aside of a life, of a vocation, perhaps even of a faith? From thoughts of that dreadful death, his mind, torn between pity, curiosity, and conjecture, turned to Margaret Munro's diary. He had read the paragraphs of the final entry so often that he could have recited them by heart. She had discovered a secret so important that she couldn't bring herself to record it except obliquely. She had spoken to the person most concerned, and within hours of that disclosure she was dead. Given the state of her heart, that death could have happened at any time. Perhaps it had been hastened by anxiety, the need to confront the implications of her discovery. But it could have been a convenient death for someone, and how easy such a murder would be. An elderly woman with a weak heart alone in her cottage, a local doctor who had seen her regularly and would have no difficulty in giving a death certificate. And why, if she was wearing the spectacles she used for watching television, had her knitting been in her lap? And if she had been watching a program when she died, who had turned off the set? All these oddities could, of course, be explained. It was the end of the day, and she was tired. Even if more evidence came to light, and what evidence could there be, there was little hope of solving the mystery now. Like Ronald Treves, she had been cremated. It struck him that St. Anselm's was oddly prompt in disposing of its dead, but that was unfair. Both Sir Alred and Mrs. Munro's sister had cut the college out of the obsequies. He wished he had actually seen Treves' body. It was always unsatisfactory to have evidence at second hand, and no photographs had been taken of the scene. But the accounts had been clear enough, and what they pointed to was suicide. But why? Treves would have seen the act as a sin, a mortal sin. What could have been strong enough to drive him to such a horrific end? Any visitor to an historic county town or city quickly becomes aware in his or her peregrinations that the most attractive houses in the centre are invariably the offices of lawyers. Messieurs Stannard, Fox and Perronet were no exception. The firm was housed within walking distance of the cathedral, in an elegant Georgian house, separated from the pavement by a narrow band of cobbles. The gleaming front door with its lion's head knocker, the glistening paintwork, the windows unsmudged by city grime, reflected the frail morning sunlight, and the immaculate net curtains all proclaimed the respectability, prosperity, and exclusiveness of the firm. In the reception office, which had obviously once been part of a larger, finely proportioned front room, a fresh-faced girl looked up from her magazine and greeted Dalgleish in a pleasant Norfolk accent. "Commander Dalgleish, isn't it? Mr. Perronet is expecting you. He said to ask you to go straight up. It's the first floor, at the front. His PA doesn't come in on Saturdays. There's only the two of us, but I could easily make you coffee if you'd like it." Smiling, Dalgleish thanked her, declined the offer, and made his way up the stairs between framed photographs of previous members of the firm. The man who was waiting for him at the door of his office and moved forward was older than his voice on the telephone had suggested, certainly in his late 50s. He was over 6 feet tall, bony, with a long jaw, mild grey eyes behind horn-rimmed spectacles, and straw-coloured hair, which lay in lank strands across a high forehead. It was the face of a comedian rather than of a lawyer. He was formally dressed in a dark pinstripe suit, obviously old but extremely well cut, its orthodoxy belied by a shirt with a broad blue stripe and a pink bow tie with blue spots. It was as if he were aware of some discordance of personality or an eccentricity which he was at pains to cultivate. The room into which Dalgleish was led was much as he had expected. The desk was Georgian and clear of paper or filing trays. There was an oil painting, no doubt of one of the founding fathers, above the elegant marble fireplace, and the watercolour landscapes, carefully aligned, were good enough to be by Cotman, and probably were. "You won't take coffee? Very wise. Too early. I go out for mine at about 11. A stroll up to St. Mary Mancroft gives me a chance to get out of the office. I hope this chair isn't too low. No, take the other, if you prefer. Father Sebastian has asked me to answer any questions you care to ask about St. Anselm's, just so. Of course, if this were an official police inquiry, I should have a duty as well as a wish to cooperate." The mildness of his grey eyes was deceptive. They could be searching. Dalgleish said, "Hardly an official inquiry. My position is ambiguous. I expect Father Sebastian has told you that Sir Alred Treves is unhappy about the verdict at the inquest on his son. He's asked the Met to make a preliminary investigation to see if there's a case for taking the matter further. I was due to be in the county, and I know something of St. Anselm's, so it seemed expedient and economical for me to make this visit. Of course, if there is any suggestion of a criminal case, the matter will become official and pass into the hands of the Suffolk Constabulary." Paul Perronet said, "Dissatisfied with the verdict, is he? I should have thought it would have come as something of a relief." He thought the evidence for accidental death was inconclusive. "So it may have been, but there was no evidence of anything else. An open verdict might have been more appropriate." Dalgleish said, "Coming at a difficult time for the college, the publicity must have been unwelcome." "Just so. But the tragedy was handled with great discretion. Father Sebastian is skilled in these matters, and St. Anselm's certainly has had worse publicity. There was the homosexual scandal in 1923, when the priest lecturer in church history, one Father Cuthbert, fell passionately in love with one of the ordinance, and they were discovered by the warden in flagrante delicto. They cycled off together on Father Cuthbert's tandem bicycle to Felixstowe Docks and Freedom, having, I presume, changed from their cassocks into Victorian knickerbockers. An engaging picture, I always think. And then there was a more serious scandal in 1932, when the then warden converted to Rome and took off the teaching staff and a third of the ordinands with him. That must have sent Agnes Arbuthnot reeling in her grave. But it's true that this latest publicity comes at an unfortunate time. Just so. Were you at the inquest yourself? Yes, I attended, representing the college. This firm has represented St. Anselm's since its foundation. Miss Arbuthnot, indeed, the Arbuthnot family generally, had a dislike of London, and when her father later moved into Suffolk and built the house in 1842, he asked us to take over his legal affairs. We were out of the county, of course, but I think he wanted an East Anglian firm rather than one necessarily in Suffolk. Miss Arbuthnot carried on the association after her father's death. One of the senior partners here has always been a trustee of the college. Miss Arbuthnot provided for this in her will, and stated that he should be a communicant member of the Church of England. I'm the present trustee. I don't know what we'll do in the future if all the partners here are Roman Catholics, nonconformists, or plain unbelievers. I suppose we'll have to persuade someone to convert. Up to now, though, there has always been a suitably qualified partner. Dalgleish said, "It's an old firm, isn't it?" "Founded in 1792. No Stannards in the firm now. The last one is an academic, one of the new universities, I believe, but we have a young fox coming on. Young vixen, rather. Priscilla Fox, qualified only last year, and very promising. I like to see continuity." Dalgleish said, "I understand from Father Martin that the death of young Treves may hasten the closure of St. Anselm's. As a trustee, is that your view?" "I'm afraid so. Hasten, mind you, not cause. The Church, as I expect you know, has a policy of centralizing its theological teaching in fewer centers. But St. Anselm's has always been something of an anomaly. It may close more quickly now, but closure, alas, is inevitable. Not just a question of church policy and resources. The ethos is out of date. St. Anselm's has always had its critics, elitist, snobbish, too isolated, even the students too well-fed. The wine is certainly remarkably fine. I take care not to make my quarterly visits in Lent or on a Friday, but most of it is bequeathed. Doesn't cost the college a penny. Old Canon Cosgrove left them his cellar 5 years ago. The old man had a fine palate. Should keep them going till they close." Dalgleish said, "And if and when they do, what happens to the buildings, the contents? Didn't Father Sebastian tell you? He told me that he would be among the beneficiaries, but referred me to you for the details." "Just so. Just so." Mr. Perronet got up from the desk and opened a cupboard to the left of the fireplace. He brought out with some effort a large box labelled Arbuthnot in white paint. He said, "If you're interested in the history of the college, and I take it you are, perhaps we should begin at the beginning. It's all here. Yes, indeed, you can read the story of a family in one large black tin box. I'll begin with Agnes Arbuthnot's father, Claude Arbuthnot, who died in 1859. He manufactured buttons and buckles. Buttons for those high boots the ladies used to wear. Ceremonial buttons and buckles, that kind of thing. At a factory outside Ipswich. Did extremely well, and made himself a very rich man. Agnes, born in 1820, was the eldest child. After her was Edwin, born in 1823, and Clara, born 2 years later. We needn't trouble ourselves with Clara. Never married and died of TB in 1849 in Italy. Buried in Rome in the Protestant cemetery, in very good company, of course. Poor Keats. Well, that's what they did in those days. Travel to the sun in the hope of a cure. The voyage was enough to kill them. Pity she didn't go to Torquay and rest up there. Anyway, exit Clara. It was the old man Claude, of course, who built the house. He'd made his pile and he wanted something to show for it.
Just so.
He left the house to Agnes. The money was divided between her and the son, Edwin, and I gather there was some dissension over the bestowal of the property. But Agnes cared for the house and lived in it, and Edwin didn't, so she got it.
Of course, if her father, a rigid Protestant, had known what she was going to do with it, things might have been different.
Still, you can't follow your property beyond the grave. He bequeathed it to her, and that was that. It was the year after his death that she went to stay with a school friend in Oxford, came under the influence of the Oxford movement, and decided to found St. Anselm's. The house was there, of course, but she built on the two cloisters, restored and incorporated the church, and built the four cottages for staff. Dalgliesh said, "What happened to Edwin?"
"He was an explorer. Except for Claude, the males in the family seem all to have had an itch for travel. Actually, he was part of some notable digs in the Middle East. He rarely came back to England and died in Cairo in 1890.
Dalgliesh said, "Was he the one who gave the St. Anselm papyrus to the college?" And now the eyes behind the horn-rimmed spectacles grew wary. There was a silence before Perronet spoke.
"So, you know about that?"
Father Sebastian didn't say.
"I know very little. My father was in on the secret, and although he was always discreet, I picked up hints when he and I were at St. Anselm's. A 14-year-old boy has sharper ears and a more inquisitive mind than adults sometimes realize. My father told me a little and made me promise to keep it secret. I don't think I was much interested in doing anything else."
Perronet said,
"Well, Father Sebastian said to answer all your questions, but there's not much I can tell you about the papyrus. You probably know as much as I.
It was certainly given to Miss Arbuthnot in 1887 by her brother, and he was certainly capable of forging it or having it forged. He was a man fond of practical jokes, and this would have appealed to him. He was a fervent atheist. Can an atheist be fervent? Anyway, he was anti-religion.
What is the papyrus exactly?"
"It purports to be a communication from Pontius Pilate to an officer of the guard regarding the removal of a certain body. Miss Arbuthnot took the view that it was a forgery, and most wardens who have seen the letter since have agreed.
I haven't myself been shown it, but my father was, and so I believe was old Stannard. My father had no doubt that it was genuine, but he said that, assuming it to have been forged, it had been done with considerable cleverness."
Dalgliesh said, "It's strange that Agnes Arbuthnot didn't have it destroyed."
"Oh, not strange, I think. No, I wouldn't call it strange. There's a note about it here among the papers. I'll just give you the gist, if you don't mind. She took the view that, if it were destroyed, her brother would make the matter public, and the fact of its destruction would serve to prove its authenticity. Once destroyed, no one could prove that it wasn't a fake. She left careful instructions that it was to be preserved in the possession of each successive warden, to be passed over to his successor only at his death."
Dalgliesh said, "Which means that Father Martin has it at present."
"That's right. Father Martin will have it somewhere in his possession. I doubt if even Father Sebastian knows where. If you require any further information about the letter, you should speak to him. I can't see how it's relevant to the death of young Treves."
Dalgliesh said, "Nor can I at present. What happened to the family after Edwin Arbuthnot's death?"
"He had a son, Hugh, born in 1880, killed in action on the Somme in 1916. My grandfather died in that action. The dead of that war still march through all our dreams, don't they? He left two sons. The elder, Edwin, born in 1903, never married and died in Alexandria in 1979. Then there was Claude, born in 1905. He was the grandfather of Raphael Arbuthnot, who is a student at the college at the present. But that, of course, you know. Raphael Arbuthnot is the last of the family.
Dalgliesh said,
"But he doesn't inherit?"
"No. Unfortunately, he's not legitimate." Miss Arbuthnot's will was detailed and specific. I don't think the dear lady ever really envisaged that the college would be closed. But my predecessor here, who was dealing with the family's affairs at the time, pointed out that this eventuality should be provided for. Just so. The will states that the property and all objects in the college and the church that were the gift of Miss Arbuthnot and are present at the time of closure should be divided in equal shares between any direct descendants of her father, provided such descendants were legitimate in English law and communicant members of the Church of England. Dalgliesh said,
"An unusual wording, surely."
"Legitimate in English law?"
"Not really." Miss Arbuthnot was typical of her class and age. Where property was concerned, the Victorians were always alive to the possibility of a foreign claimant of doubtful legitimacy born of an irregularly contracted foreign marriage. There are some notorious cases. Failing a legitimate heir, the property and the contents are to be divided, again in equal shares, between the priests resident in the college at the time of its closure. Dalgliesh said,
"Which means that the beneficiaries are Father Sebastian Morel, Father Martin Petrie, Father Peregrine Glover, and Father John Betterton. That's a little hard on Raphael, isn't it? I suppose there's no doubt about the illegitimacy."
"On the first point, I would have to agree. The unfairness has not, of course, escaped Father Sebastian. The question of closing the college first arose seriously 2 years ago, and he spoke to me then. He somewhat naturally is unhappy about the terms of the will and suggested that, in the event of closure, some arrangement should be arrived at between the beneficiaries to ensure that Raphael benefits. Normally, of course, bequests can be varied by agreement of the beneficiaries, but the matter here is complicated. I told him that I couldn't give quick or easy answers to any questions relating to the disposal of the property. There is, for example, the extremely valuable painting in the church. Miss Arbuthnot gave it to the church, particularly to be used above the altar. If the church is to remain consecrated, should it be moved, or should some arrangement be made whereby whoever is responsible for the church can acquire it? The recently appointed trustee, Archdeacon Crampton, has been agitating to have it removed now, either to a place of greater safety or to be sold for the benefit of the diocese generally. He would like to have all the valuable items removed. I've told him that I would regret any such premature action, but he may well get his way. He has considerable influence, and such action would, of course, ensure that the church, rather than individuals, will benefit when the college closes. Then there is the problem of the buildings. I confess I can't see an obvious use for them, and they may well not be standing in 20 years' time. The sea is advancing rapidly along that coast. The erosion, of course, considerably affects their value. The contents, even without the picture, are likely to be more valuable, the silver, the books, and the furnishings, particularly so. Dalgliesh said,
"And then there's the St. Anselm papyrus." Again, he thought the reference was unwelcome.
Perrinet said, "Presumably that too will pass to the beneficiaries. That could create a particular difficulty. But if the college closes, and there is subsequently no warden, then the papyrus will form part of the estate. But it is, presumably, a valuable object, authentic or otherwise."
Paul Perrinet said, "It would have considerable value to anyone interested, either in money or in power."
"Like Sir Alred Treves," thought Dalgliesh. But it was difficult to imagine Sir Alred deliberately introducing his adopted son into the college with the purpose of getting hold of the St. Anselm papyrus, even if he had evidence of its existence. He said, "There's no doubt, I suppose, of Raphael's illegitimacy."
"Oh, indeed no, Commander, indeed no. His mother, when pregnant, made no secret of the fact that she was neither married nor had any wish to be. She never revealed the name of her father, although she did express her contempt and hatred for him. After the child was born, she literally dumped him at the college in a basket with a note which said, "You are supposed to go in for Christian charity, so practice it on this bastard. If you want money, ask my father." The note is here among the Arbuthnot papers. It was an extraordinary thing for a mother to do. It was indeed, thought Dalgliesh. Women did abandon their children. Sometimes they even murdered them. But there had been a calculated brutality about this rejection, and by a woman, surely not without money and friends. She went abroad immediately, and I believe travelled extensively in the Far East and India for the next 10 years or so. I believe that for most of the time she was in the company of a friend, a woman doctor who committed suicide just before Clara Arbuthnot returned to England. Clara died of cancer in Ashcombe House, a hospice outside Norwich, on 30 April 1988. Without ever seeing the child, she neither saw nor took any interest in him. Of course, she died tragically young. Things might have changed. Her father, who was over 50 when he married, was an old man by the time his grandson was born. Couldn't have coped, and didn't want to. But he did set up a small trust fund. The warden here at the time was made legal guardian after the grandfather's death. Effectively, the college has been Raphael's home. The fathers have, on the whole, done extremely well by the boy. They thought it right he should go away to prep school and have the company of other boys, and I think this was wise. And then, of course, there was public school. The trust fund just ran to the fees, but he's been at the college for most of the holidays. The telephone on the desk rang. Paul Perrinet said, "Sally tells me my next caller has arrived. Is there anything else you need to know, Commander?" "Nothing, thank you. I'm not sure how relevant any of this will prove, but I'm glad to be put in the picture. Thank you for taking so much time over the matter." Perrinet said, "We seem to have travelled very far from that poor boy's death. You will, of course, let me know the result of your inquiries. As a trustee, I have an interest." "Just so." Dalgliesh promised that he would. He made his way up the sunlit street towards the soaring splendour of St. Mary Mancroft. This, after all, was supposed to be a holiday. He was entitled to spend at least an hour on his own pleasures. He pondered what he had learned. It was an odd coincidence that Clara Arbuthnot had died in the same hospice where Margaret Munro had been a nurse. But perhaps not so very odd. Miss Arbuthnot might well have wanted to die in the county of her birth. The job at St. Anselm's would have been advertised locally, and Mrs. Munro had been looking for a post. But the two women could not have met. He would have to check the dates, but it was clear in his own mind. Miss Arbuthnot had died a month before Margaret Munro had taken up her post at the hospice. But the other fact he had learned was an uncomfortable complication. Whatever the truth about Ronald Treves' death, it had brought nearer the closure of St. Anselm's College. And when that closure took place, 4 members of the staff would become very rich men. He had decided that St. Anselm's would welcome his absence for most of the day, but had told Father Martin that he would be in for dinner. After 2 hours' satisfying exploration of the city, he found a restaurant where neither food nor decor was pretentious, and ate a simple lunch. There was something else he needed to do before returning to the college. Consulting the telephone directory at the restaurant, he discovered the address of the publishers of the Soul Bay Weekly Gazette. Their office, from which they published a number of local papers and magazines, was a low brick building rather like a garage, close to one of the road junctions outside the city. There was no problem in obtaining back copies of the paper. Karen Surtees' memory had not been at fault. The issue for the week before Mrs. Munro's death did indeed carry a picture
of the ribbon-bedecked heifer at Herona's graveside. Dalgliesh had parked in the forecourt in front of the building and now returned to the car and studied the newspaper. It was a typical provincial weekly. Its preoccupation with local life and rural and small-town interests, a refreshing relief from the predictable concerns of the national broadsheets. Here were reports from the villages of whist drives, sales of work, darts competitions, funerals and meetings of local groups and associations. There was a page of photographs of brides and grooms, heads together, smiling into the camera, and several pages of advertisements for houses, cottages, and bungalows with pictures of the properties. Four pages were devoted to personal notices and other advertisements. Only two items hinted at the less innocent concerns of the wider world. Seven illegal immigrants had been discovered in a barn, and it was suspected that they had been brought in on a local boat. The police had made two arrests in connection with the finding of cocaine, raising suspicion that there could be a local dealer. Folding the paper, Dalgliesh reflected that his hunch had come to nothing. If anything in the Gazette had sparked off Margaret Munro's memory, the secret had died with her. 18. The Reverend Matthew Crampton, Archdeacon of Raiden, drove to St. Anselm's by the shortest route from his vicarage at Cressingfield, just south of Ipswich. He drove towards the A12 with the comfortable assurance that he had left the parish, his wife, and his study in good order. Even in youth, he had never left home without the assumption, never voiced aloud, that he might not return. It was never a serious worry, but the thought was always there, like other unacknowledged fears which curled like a sleeping snake in the pit of his mind. It sometimes occurred to him that he lived his whole life in the daily expectation of its ending. The small diurnal rituals which this involved had nothing to do with a morbid preoccupation with mortality, nor with his faith, but were more, he acknowledged, a legacy of his mother's insistence every morning on clean underclothes, since this might be the day on which he would be run over and exposed to the gaze of nurses, doctors, and the undertaker as a pitiable victim of maternal unconcern. As a boy, he had sometimes pictured the final scene, himself stretched out on a mortuary slab, and his mother comforted and gratified by the thought that he had at least died with his pants clean. He had tidied away his first marriage as methodically as he tidied his desk. That silent visitation at the corner of the stair, or glimpsed through his study window, the sudden shock of hearing a half-remembered laugh, were mercifully supine, overlaid by parish duties, the weekly routine, his second marriage. He had consigned his first marriage to a dark oubliette of his mind and shot the bolt, but not before he had almost formally passed sentence on it. He had heard one of his parishioners, the mother of a child who was dyslexic and slightly deaf, describing how her daughter had been statemented by the local authority, and had understood that this meant that the child's needs had been assessed and appropriate measures agreed on. So in a very different context, but with equal authority, he had statemented his marriage. The words, unspoken, had never been consigned to paper, but mentally he could recite them as if he were speaking of a casual acquaintance, and always of himself in the third person. That brief and final disposal of a marriage was written on his mind, pictured always in italics. Archdeacon Crampton married his first wife soon after he became vicar of his inner city parish. Barbara Hampton was 10 years younger, beautiful, willful, and disturbed, a fact which her family had never disclosed. The marriage had at first been happy. He knew himself to be the fortunate husband of a woman he had done little to deserve. Her sentimentality was taken for kindness. Her easy familiarity with strangers, her beauty and her generosity
made her very popular in the parish. For months the problems were either unacknowledged or not spoken of, and then the church wardens and parishioners would call at the vicarage when she was away and tell their embarrassed stories. The outbursts of violent temper, the screaming, the insults, incidents which he had thought happened only to and with him, had spread into the parish. She refused treatment, arguing that it was he who was sick. She began to drink more steadily and more heavily. One afternoon, 4 years after the wedding, he was due to go out to visit sick parishioners, and knowing that she had gone to bed that afternoon pleading tiredness, had gone to see how she was. Opening the door, he thought that she was sleeping peacefully and left, not wishing to disturb her. On his return that evening, he found that she was dead. She had taken an overdose of aspirin. The inquest returned a verdict of suicide. He blamed himself for having married a woman too young for him and unsuitable to be a vicar's wife. He found happiness in a second and more appropriate marriage, but he never ceased to mourn his first wife. That was the story as mentally he recited it, but now he returned to it far less often. He had married again within 18 months. An unmarried vicar, particularly one who has been tragically widowed, is inevitably regarded as the lawful target of the parish matchmakers. It seemed to him that his second wife had been chosen for him, an arrangement in which he had happily acquiesced. Today he had a job to do, and it was one he relished, while convincing himself that it was a duty, to persuade Sebastian Morel that St. Anselm's had to be closed, and to find any additional evidence that would help to make that closure as speedy as it was inevitable. He told himself, and believed, that St. Anselm's, expensive to maintain, remote with only 20 carefully selected students, overprivileged and elitist, was an example of everything that was wrong with the Church of England. He admitted, and mentally congratulated himself on his honesty, that his dislike of the institution extended to its principle. Why on earth should the man be called warden? And that dislike was strongly personal, going well beyond any difference in churchmanship or theology. Partly, he admitted, it was class resentment. He thought of himself as having fought his way to ordination and preferment. In fact, little struggle had been necessary. In his university days, his path had been smoothed by not ungenerous grants, and his mother had always indulged her only child. But Morel was the son and the grandson of bishops, and an 18th-century forebear had been one of the great prince-bishops of the church. The Morels had always been at home in palaces, and the archdeacon knew that his adversary would put out his tentacles of family and personal influence to reach the sources of power in Whitehall, the universities, and the church, and wouldn't yield an inch of ground in the fight to keep his fiefdom. And there had been that dreadful horse-faced wife of his. God only knew why he had married her. Lady Veronica had been in residence at the college on the archdeacon's first visit, long before he was appointed as a trustee, and had sat on his left at dinner. The occasion had not been a happy one for either of them. Well, she was dead now. At least he would be spared that braying, offensively upper-class voice, which it took centuries of arrogance and insensitivity to develop. What had she or her husband ever known of poverty and its humiliating deprivations? When had they ever had to live with the violence and the intractable problems of a decayed inner-city parish? Morel had never even served as a parish priest, except for 2 years in a fashionable provincial town. And why a man of his intellectual ability and reputation should be content to be principal of a small, isolated theological college was something of a mystery to the archdeacon, and, he suspected, not only to him. But there could, of course, be an explanation, and it lay in the terms of Miss Arbuthnot's deplorable will. How on earth had her legal advisers allowed her to make it? Of course she couldn't have known that the pictures and the silver she had given to St. Anselm's would so appreciate in value over nearly a century and a half. In recent years, St. Anselm's had been supported by the church. It was morally just that when the college became redundant, the asset should go to the church or to church charities. It was inconceivable that Miss Arbuthnot had intended to make multimillionaires of the four priests fortuitously in residence at the time of the closure, one of them aged 80, and another a convicted child abuser. He would make it his business to ensure that all valuables were removed from the college before it was formally closed. Sebastian Morel could hardly oppose the move without laying himself open to the accusation of selfishness and greed. His devious campaign to keep St. Anselm's open was probably a ruse to conceal his interest in the spoils. The battle lines had been formally drawn, and he was on his confident way to what he expected would be a decisive skirmish. 19. Father Sebastian knew that he would have to have a confrontation with the Archdeacon before the weekend was over, but he didn't intend it to take place in the church. He was prepared, even eager to stand his ground, but not before the altar. But when the Archdeacon said that he would like now to see the Roger van der Weyden, Father Sebastian, having no excuse for not accompanying him, and feeling that merely to hand over the keys would be uncivil, consoled himself with the thought that the visit would probably be short. What, after all, could the Archdeacon object to in the church, except perhaps the lingering smell of incense? He made a resolution to keep an even temper, and, if possible, to restrict the conversation to superficialities. Surely in church, two priests could talk to each other without acrimony. They made their way down the north cloister to the sacristy door without speaking. Nothing was said until Father Sebastian had switched on the light illuminating the picture, and they stood side by side regarding it in silence. Father Sebastian had never found words adequate to describe the effect on him of this sudden revelation of the image, and he didn't attempt to find them now. It was a full half minute before the Archdeacon spoke. His voice boomed unnaturally loud in the silent air. "It shouldn't be here, of course. Haven't you ever given serious thought to having it moved?" "Moved where, Archdeacon?" "It was given to the college by Miss Arbuthnot precisely to be placed in the church and over the altar." "Hardly a safe place for something so valuable. What's it worth, do you think? 5 million? 8 million? 10 million? "I've no idea. As far as safety is concerned, the altarpiece has been in place for over 100 years. To where exactly do you propose it should be removed?" "To somewhere safer. Somewhere where other people can enjoy it. The most sensible course, and I've discussed this with the bishop, would be to sell it to a museum, where it would be on public view. The church, or indeed any worthwhile charity, could find a good use for the money. The same applies to the two most valuable of your chalices. It is inappropriate that objects of such value should be kept for the private satisfaction of 20 ordinands. Father Sebastian was tempted to quote a verse of Scripture. "For this ointment might have been sold for much and given to the poor," but prudently forbore. But he couldn't keep the note of outrage from his voice. "The altarpiece is the property of this college. It will certainly not be sold while I am warden, nor will it be removed. The silver will be kept in the sanctuary safe and used for the purpose for which it was made. Even though its presence means that the church has to be kept locked and is unavailable to the ordinance, it isn't unavailable. They have only to ask for the keys. The need to pray is sometimes more spontaneous than remembering to ask for a key. That's why we have the oratory." The Archdeacon turned away, and Father Sebastian walked over to switch off the light. His companion said, "In any case, when the college is closed, the picture will have to be removed. I don't know what the diocese has in mind for this place. I mean the church itself.
It's too remote to serve again as a parish church, even as part of a team ministry. Where would you get a congregation? It's unlikely that whoever buys the house will want a private chapel, but you never know. It's difficult to see who would be interested in buying. Remote, inconvenient to run, difficult to reach, and with no direct access to the beach. It would hardly be suitable for a hotel or convalescent home, and with the coast erosion, there's no certainty it will be here in 20 years' time.
Father Sebastian waited until he could be sure of speaking calmly.
You talk, Archdeacon, as if the decision to close St. Anselm's has already been taken. I assumed that, as warden, I would be consulted. No one yet has spoken or written to me.
Naturally, you will be consulted. All the necessary, tedious processes will be followed, but the end is inevitable. You know that perfectly well. The Church of England is centralizing and rationalizing its theological training. Reform is long overdue. St. Anselm's is too small, too remote, too expensive, and too elitist.
Elitist, Archdeacon?
I use the word deliberately. When did you last accept an ordinance from the state educational system?
Stephen Morby came through the state system. He's probably our most intelligent ordinant.
The first, I suspect, and no doubt by way of Oxford and with the required first. And when will you accept a woman as ordinant, or a woman priest on the staff, for that matter?
No woman has ever applied.
Precisely, because women know when they're not wanted.
I think that recent history would disprove that, Archdeacon. We have no prejudices. The church, or rather synod, has made its decision. But this place is too small to cope with women ordinands. Even the larger theological colleges are finding it difficult. It's the ordinands who suffer. I will not preside over a Christian institution in which some members refuse to take the sacrament at the hands of others.
And elitism isn't your only problem. Unless the church adapts itself to meet the needs of the 21st century, it will die. The life your young men live here is ridiculously privileged, totally remote from the lives of the men and women they will be expected to serve. The study of Greek and Hebrew have their place, I'm not denying that. But we need also to look at what the newer disciplines can offer. What training do they receive in sociology, in race relations, in interfaith cooperation?
Father Sebastian managed to keep his voice steady. He said, "The training provided here is among the best in the country. Our inspection reports make that plain, and it's ludicrous to claim that anyone here is out of touch with the real world or isn't being trained to minister to that world. Priests have gone out from St. Anselm's to serve in the most deprived and difficult areas here and overseas. What about Father Donovan, who died of typhoid in the East End because he wouldn't leave his flock, or Father Bruce, martyred in Africa? And there are others. St. Anselm's has educated two of the century's most distinguished bishops.
They were bishops for their age, not ours. You're talking about the past.
I'm concerned with the needs of the present, particularly of the young. We won't bring people to the faith without worn conventions, an archaic liturgy, and a church that is seen as pretentious, boring, middle-class, racist even. St. Anselm's has become irrelevant to the new age."
Father Sebastian said, "What is it that you want? A church without mystery, stripped of that learning, tolerance, and dignity that were the virtues of Anglicanism? A church without humility in the face of the ineffable mystery and love of Almighty God? Services with banal hymns, a debased liturgy, and the Eucharist conducted as if it were a parish bean feast? A church for cool Britannia? That is not how I conduct services at St. Anselm's. I'm sorry. I recognize that there are legitimate differences in how we view the priesthood. I wasn't being personal."
The Archdeacon said,
"Oh, but I think you were. Let me be frank, Morrell."
"You have been frank. And is this the place for it?"
"St. Anselm's will be closed. It has served the past well, no doubt, but it is irrelevant to the present. Its teaching is good, but is it any better than was that of Chichester, Salisbury, Lincoln? They had to accept closure.
It will not be closed. It will not be closed in my lifetime. I'm not without influence.
Oh, we know that. That's exactly what I'm complaining about. The power of influence, knowing the right people, moving in the right circles, a word in the right ear. That view of England is as out of date as the college. Lady Veronica's world is dead.
But now Father Sebastian's barely controlled anger found trembling release. He could hardly speak, but the words, distorted with hatred, came out at last in a voice he hardly recognized as his own.
How dare you! How dare you even mention my wife's name?
They glared at each other like pugilists. It was the Archdeacon who found voice.
I'm sorry. I've been intemperate and uncharitable. The wrong words in the wrong place. Shall we go?
He made as if to hold out his hand and then decided against it. They walked in silence along the north wall to the door of the sacristy. Father Sebastian suddenly halted. He said, "There's someone here with us." "We're not alone." They stood for a few seconds and listened. The Archdeacon said, "I can hear nothing. The church is obviously empty except for us. The door was locked and the alarm set when we arrived. There's no one here." "Of course not. How could they be? It was just a feeling I had." Father Sebastian set the alarm and locked the outside door to the sacristy behind them, and they passed together into the north cloister. The apology had been uttered, but words had been spoken by both which Father Sebastian knew could never be forgotten. He was filled with self-disgust at his loss of control. Both he and the Archdeacon had been at fault, but he was the host, and he was the more responsible. And the Archdeacon had only articulated what others thought, others were saying. He felt the descent of a profound depression, and with it came a less familiar emotion, and one more acute than apprehension. It was fear.
20.
Afternoon tea on Saturdays at St. Anselm's was an informal affair, prepared by Mrs. Pilbeam and laid out in the students' sitting room at the back of the house for those who had indicated that they would be in. The number was usually small, particularly if there was a football match worth attending within reasonable distance. The time was 3 o'clock, and Emma, Raphael Abuthnot, Henry Bloxham and Stephen Morby were lazing in Mrs. Pilbeam's sitting room, which lay between the main kitchen and the passage leading into the south cloister. It was from this same passage that a flight of steep stairs led down to the cellar. The kitchen, with its 4-oven aga, its shining steel working surfaces and modern equipment, was out of bounds to the students. It was here, in her small sitting room, next door with its single gas stove and square wooden table, that Mrs. Pilbeam often chose to cook scones and cake and prepare tea. The room was cosily domestic, even a little shabby in contrast to the surgical cleanliness of the uncluttered kitchen. The original fireplace with its decorated iron hood was still in place and, although the glowing nuggets were now synthetic and the fuel was gas, it gave a comforting focus to the room. The sitting room was very much Mrs. Pilbeam's domain. The mantel shelf held some of her personal treasures, most of them brought back from holidays by former students. A decorated teapot, an assortment of mugs and jugs, the china dog she liked, and even a small, gaudily dressed doll whose thin legs dangled over the edge of the mantel shelf. Mrs. Pilbeam had 3 sons, now widely scattered, and Emma guessed that she enjoyed those weekly sessions with the young as much as the Ordnance welcomed the relief from the masculine austerity of their daily routine. Like them, Emma took comfort from Mrs. Pilbeam's maternal but unsentimental affection. She wondered whether Father Sebastian altogether approved of her joining in these informal get-togethers. She had no doubt that he knew. Little that went on in college escaped Father Sebastian's notice. This afternoon there were only the 3 students present. Peter Buckhurst, still convalescent from glandular fever, was resting in his room. Emma was curled among the cushions of a wicker chair to the right of the fireplace, with Raphael's long legs stretched out from the opposite chair. Henry had spread a section of the Saturday edition of the Times over one end of the table, while at the other Stephen was being given a cookery lesson by Mrs. Pilbeam. His North Country mother, in the immaculate terraced house in which he had been brought up, believed that son should not be expected to help with the housework. So had her own mother believed, and her mother before her. But Stephen, while at Oxford, had become engaged to a brilliant young geneticist with more egalitarian, less accommodating views. This afternoon, with the encouragement of Mrs. Pilbeam and the occasional criticisms of his fellow ordinands, he was tackling pastry-making and was now rubbing a mixture of lard and butter into the flour. Mrs. Pilbeam remonstrated. "Not like that, Mr. Stephen. Use your fingers gently. Lift up your hands and let the mixture trickle down into the bowl. That way it collects plenty of air." "But I feel a right Charlie," Henry said. "You look a right Charlie. If your Alison could see you now, she'd have grave doubts about your ability to father the two brilliant children you're no doubt planning for." "No, she wouldn't," said Stephen, and gave a happy, reminiscent smile. "That still looks a funny colour. Why don't you go to the supermarket? They sell perfectly good pastry from the freezer." "There's nothing like homemade pastry, Mr. Henry. Don't discourage him. Now, that looks about right. Start adding the cold water. No, don't reach for the jug. It has to go in a spoonful at a time." Stephen said, "I had quite a good recipe for chicken casserole when I had digs at Oxford. You just buy pieces of chicken from the supermarket, then add a tin of mushroom soup. Or you can have tomato, any soup, really. It always comes out all right." "Is this done, Mrs. P?" Mrs. Pilbeam peered into the bowl, where the dough had finally been formed into a glistening lump. "We'll be doing casseroles next week. Looks quite good. Now we'll wrap it in cling film and put it in the fridge to rest." "Why does it want to rest? I'm the one who's exhausted. Does it always go that colour? It looks kind of dingy." Raphael roused himself and said, "Where's the sleuth?" It was Henry who answered, eyes still on his paper. "Not in until dinner, apparently. I saw him driving off immediately after breakfast. I must say, I saw him go with some relief. He isn't exactly a comfortable presence about the place." Stephen asked, "What can he possibly hope to discover? He can't reopen the inquest. Or can he? Can you have a second inquest on a cremated body?" Henry looked up and said, "I imagine not without difficulty. Ask Dalgleish, he's the expert," and returned to the Times. Stephen went to the sink to wash the flour from his hands. He said, "I've a bit of a conscience about Ronald. We didn't take much trouble over him, did we?" "Trouble? Were we expected to take trouble? St. Anselm's isn't a prep school." Raphael's voice assumed a high, pedantic half-whine. "This is young Treves, Arbuthnot. He'll be in your dormitory. Keep an eye on him, will you? Show him the ropes." Perhaps Ronald thought he was back at school, that awful habit he had of labelling everything. Name tabs on all his clothes, sticky labels on everything else. What did he think we were going to do, steal from him? Henry said, "Every sudden death produces predictable emotions. Shock, grief, anger, guilt. We've got over the shock. We didn't feel much grief, and we've no reason to feel angry. That leaves guilt. There's going to be a boring uniformity about our next confessions. Father Beeding will get tired of hearing the name Ronald Treves." Intrigued, Emma asked, "Don't the priests at St. Anselm's hear your confessions?" Henry laughed. "Good Lord, no. We may be incestuous, but we're not as incestuous as that. A priest comes twice a term from Framlingham." He had finished with his paper and now folded it carefully. "Talking of Ronald, did I tell you that I saw him on the Friday evening before he died?" Raphael said, "No, you didn't. Saw him where?" "Leaving the piggery." "What was he doing there?" "How do I know? Scratching the pigs' backs, I suppose. Actually, I thought he was distressed, for a moment even crying.
I don't think he saw me. He blundered past me onto the headland.
Did you say anything about this to the police?
No, I didn't say anything to anyone.
All the police asked me, with, I thought, a crushing lack of tact, was whether I thought Ronald had any reason to kill himself. Leaving the piggery the night before, even in a state of distress, would hardly warrant sticking your head under a ton of sand, and I couldn't be certain what I'd seen. He almost brushed against me, but it was dark. I could have imagined it. Eric said nothing, presumably, or it would have been brought out at the inquest. Anyway, Ronald was seen later that evening by Mr. Gregory, who said that he was all right during his Greek lesson. Stephen said, "It was odd, though, wasn't it?" Odder in retrospect than it seemed at the time. I can't get it out of my mind. And Ronald does rather hang about the place, doesn't he? Sometimes he seems more physically present, more real, than he was when he was alive. There was a silence. Emma hadn't spoken. She looked across at Henry and wished, as she often did, that she had some clue to his character. She remembered a conversation with Raphael soon after Henry had joined the college. "Henry puzzles me. Doesn't he you?" She had said, "You all puzzle me." "That's good. We don't want to be transparent. Besides, you puzzle us. But Henry, what's he doing here?" "Much the same as you, I imagine. If I earned $500,000 clear each year with the prospect of another million bonus for good behavior every Christmas, I doubt I'd want to give it up for $17,000 a year, if you're lucky, and not even a decent vicarage any longer. They've been sold off to yuppie families with a taste for Victorian architecture. All we'll get is some ghastly semi with parking space for the second-hand Fiesta. Remember that uncomfortable passage in St. Luke? The rich young man turning away sorrowful because he had great possessions. I can see myself in him all right. Luckily, I'm poor and a bastard. Do you think God has arranged that we're never faced with temptations that he knows perfectly well he hasn't given us the strength to resist?" Emma had said, "The history of the 20th century hardly supports that thesis." "Perhaps I'll put the idea to Father Sebastian. Suggest I might work it up into a sermon." On second thoughts, perhaps not. Raphael's voice recalled her to the present. He said, "Ronald was a bit of a drag on your course, wasn't he? The careful preparation so that he could think of intelligent questions to ask, all that assiduous scribbling. He was probably taking down useful passages for future sermons. There's nothing like an infusion of verse to raise the mediocre to the memorable. Especially if the congregation doesn't realize that you're quoting." Emma said, "I did sometimes wonder why he came. The seminars are voluntary, aren't they?" Raphael gave a hoarse, half-ironic, half-mirthful laugh. It jarred on Emma. "Yes, my dear, absolutely. It's just that in this place, voluntary doesn't quite mean the same as it does elsewhere. Let's say some behavior is more acceptable than others." "Oh, dear, and I thought you all came because you enjoy the poetry." Stephen said, "We do enjoy the poetry. The trouble is that there are only 20 of us. That means that we're always under scrutiny. The priests can't help it. It's a question of numbers. That's why the church thinks that 60 is about the right size for a theological college, and the church is right. The archdeacon has a point when he says we're too small." Raphael said crossly, "Oh, the archdeacon, do we have to talk about him?" "All right, we won't. He's an odd mixture, though, isn't he? Admittedly, the Church of England is 4 different churches, not one. But where exactly does he fit in? He's not a clap-happy. He's a Bible evangelical, yet he accepts women priests. He's always saying that we must change to serve the new century. But he's hardly representative of liberal theology, and he's uncompromising on divorce and abortion." Henry said, "He's a Victorian throwback. When he's here, I feel I'm in a Trollope novel, except that the roles have got reversed. Father Sebastian ought to be Archdeacon Grantly, with Crampton playing Slope." Stephen said, "No, not Slope. Slope was a hypocrite.
The Archdeacon is at least sincere. Raphael said, Oh, he's sincere, all right. Hitler was sincere. Genghis Khan was sincere. Every tyrant's sincere. Stephen said mildly, He's not a tyrant in his parish. Actually, I think he's a good parish priest. Don't forget, I spent a week secondment there last Easter. They like him. They even like his sermons. As one of the church wardens said, He knows what he believes, and he gives it to us straight. And there's not a person in this parish in grief or need who hasn't been grateful to him. We see him at his worst. He's a different man when he's here. Raphael said, He pursued a fellow priest and got him jailed. Is that Christian charity? He hates Father Sebastian. So much for brotherly love, and he hates this place and all it stands for. He's trying to get St. Anselm's closed. Henry said, And Father Sebastian is working to keep it open. I know where my money is. I'm not so sure. Ronald's death didn't help. The church can't close down a theological college because one of the students gets himself killed. Anyway, he's due to go after breakfast on Sunday. Apparently he's needed back in the parish. Only two more meals to get through. You'd better behave yourself, Raphael. I've had a finger-wagging from Father Sebastian. I shall attempt to exercise impressive control. And if you fail, you'll apologize to the Archdeacon before he leaves in the morning? Oh, no, said Raphael. I've a feeling no one will be apologizing to the Archdeacon in the morning. 10 minutes later, the ordnance had left for tea in the student sitting room. Mrs. Pilbeam said, You look tired, miss. Stay and have a bite of tea with me if you like. Now that you're cozy, it would be more peaceful. I'd like that, Mrs. P. Thank you. Mrs. Pilbeam drew up a low table beside her and placed on it a large cup of tea and a buttered scone with jam. How good it was, thought Emma, to be sitting in peace and with another woman, hearing the creak of the wicker chair as Mrs. Pilbeam settled herself, smelling the warm, buttery scones and watching the blue flames of the fire. She wished that they hadn't spoken about Ronald Treves. She didn't realize how much that still mysterious death could overshadow the college. And not only that death. Mrs. Munro had died naturally, peacefully, had perhaps